standpoint, it's the most efficient way to get the results that we desire.
The state proposes aerial predator control for bears. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 12th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the icebreakers pick up the pace on the way to Nome.
For lack of a better description, they've removed their training wheels and both vessels are moving more effectively and efficiently.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by Providence Health and Services Alaska and North Rim Bank.
The Board of Game will consider instituting the state's first aerial predator control program for bears at its annual statewide meeting that convenes tomorrow in Anchorage. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game says it's proposing the program for a section near the Kuskokwim River where the moose population has struggled in recent years. The board will also decide whether to implement a wolf predator control plan on the Kenai Peninsula for the first time. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The predator control proposal involves Unit 19A, an area east of Bethel along the Kuskokwim River. David James is a regional supervisor with the Fish and Game Department based out of Fairbanks. He says aerial wolf control in the area has dramatically reduced wolf numbers, but the moose population has not recovered. And he says that's not surprising given the number of bears.
What is being proposed for the board to consider is to allow department personnel to go into the area in helicopters and actually use aerial shooting if necessary to reduce the bear population in a relatively small area, something over 500 square miles.
James says he doesn't know how many bears the program would target, but it would involve shooting both black and brown bears.
From a biological standpoint, it's the most efficient way to get the results that we desire.
James says moose populations are so low, hunting is either closed or severely restricted in the area, with a devastating impact on local families who count on the meat to fill their freezers. And that has made it one of the highest management priorities in the region. But he says the Board of Game, with input from the public, will make the final decision.
The confounding issue is whether the Alaskan public finds this an acceptable way to manage bears or not. And in so much of what we do, That's an overriding consideration, and that's where the public process kicks in. That's why there's a Board of Game and advisory committees and various avenues for the public to weigh in.
The Board of Game makes most proposals available on its website at least a month before they come up at a meeting. But this is an amendment to a current proposal, and it's still not out publicly. That troubles conservation groups. Valerie Connor with Alaska Center for the Environment calls the move shocking and cowardly.
Killing bears from airplanes has never been allowed before. And then to try to slip this in at the last minute, it just shows really how badly we need some new leadership in the Department of Fish and Game and a complete overhaul of the Board of Game.
Connor is also concerned about a proposal to allow public bear snaring in the same unit. That involves attaching a bucket of bait to a tree. When a bear goes for the food, the snare catches its paw.
Picture it's a female bear and her cubs are right there, you know, and there's no requirement for someone to be, you know, manning the station. So it's not like the bear will just be killed immediately after it gets caught. I don't know how long the bear might be hanging there by its paw.
Two other proposals drawing criticism from conservation groups would allow predator control of wolves on the Kenai Peninsula for the first time. The state wants to boost two different moose populations on the northern and southern Kenai. But Teresa Fiorino with Defenders of Wildlife says predation by wolves isn't causing either problem, and so the wolves should not be targeted.
People living and recreating on the Kenai don't want aerial predator control. The advisory councils are not even supportive of wolf control as a means to help moose populations on the Kenai. Also, the feasibility assessments that were developed by the department for these proposals lack any scientific credibility.
The chances that some form of aerial predator control on the Kenai will pass at the Board of Game meeting are good, according to Tony Cavalock, the state's assistant director for the Division of Wildlife Conservation. He says it's important to do something to boost the moose populations there.
Certainly we're hearing from the public, too, through the advisory committee process and also through the board, but from the public in general. We have hunters that are increasingly dissatisfied with the opportunity to find illegal bull moose, in some cases there on the peninsula. The opportunity has reduced over the last several years.
The Board of Game meeting runs through January 18th at the Hilton in downtown Anchorage. Public testimony is scheduled to begin Friday, probably in the afternoon, and continue at least through Saturday. The board has more than 250 proposals to consider. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Anchorage Attorney Michael Garrity has gotten the nod to be the state's next Attorney General. Governor Parnell today chose Garrity as the replacement for Fairbanks Attorney John Burns, who left the office on January 2nd. Garrity was born and grew up in Fairbanks before joining his current law firm in 1979. He says he's looking forward to taking the step from private practice into public service.
My intent is just to get up to speed on where the issues are, and to my predecessor was doing a fine job, and I'm going to continue in his footsteps and give it my own stamp and my own independent analysis, certainly. But I don't have a big agenda. You know, I serve the governor and the people of the state of Alaska.
Garrity has received national recognition in his handling of cases in personal litigation and construction law. The appointment will go to the House and Senate Judiciary Committees for consideration. The full legislature will have to approve the appointment in a joint session, although Garrity can begin the job before then. The Renda and the Healy may be close to Nome by late tonight. From KNOM in Nome, Ben Matheson reports.
The two were 42 nautical miles southwest of Nome this afternoon, according to Vitus Marine CEO Mark Smith.
My expectation is that we'll arrive offshore tonight, probably give the crews a good rest, and at first light tomorrow begin our planning on just how we're going to place the ship.
Securing the ship in the shore fast ice for fueling operations is the next critical step.
There's been no problem having the Renda stick to the ice. So I think there's not a whole lot of concern, especially at these very frigid temperatures, that wherever we stop the Renda, we should see it refreeze into position within 3 hours.
The vessels today encountered less wind-induced ice pressure and easier moving, but there is more challenging ice ahead. Kathleen Cole from the National Weather Service Ice Desk says the vessels will soon encounter some of the thickest ice they've seen so far, with 80% estimated to be over 3 feet thick. Ice over 4 feet thick is possible as well, not including the ridges that could be thicker. But Cole says the majority of ice will be similar to what they've already seen.
Most of what they'll see will be in the 2 to 3 foot range, which is what they've been seeing, but we will have less dense ice, so the concentration of ice will be lower, which should give them room to maneuver.
Marine pilot Captain Carter Whalen is in daily communication with the Renda. He says the teamwork between the tanker and the icebreaker Healy has moved to a new level.
For lack of a better description, they've removed their training wheels and both vessels are moving more effectively and efficiently as far as the timing and station keeping and management of ice and speed. Both vessels are progressing very well.
Just outside of the harbor entrance in Nome, crews smoothed out a wide area of rubbled ice for hose operations. According to John Catula, the manager of the Marine Vessel Section for the DEC.
Where there's some rough terrain that we're going to be smoothing down so that we can run the hose properly, and if there was some type of a problem and we developed a leak, that we'd be able to respond to that leak. So just getting all the final touches in place.
And in preparing to enforce the safety zone in place around the fuel transfer hose and the Renda, Nome Volunteer Fire Department personnel conducted snow machine and security training with the Coast Guard. That's to prepare for managing the crowds that come out to see the Renda. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a good deed to help a man from Haiti that didn't go as planned.
of failing is not the story. The story is that compassion heals.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
The snow-clogged town of Cordova had rain yesterday, adding pounds to the snow, increasing avalanche danger, and complicating the cleanup. But a new great machine is also making things a little easier. KTOO's Rosemarie Alexander has this update.
Former Cordova Mayor Tim Joyce is the new information officer for the small Prince William Sound community. The job didn't exist until the world found out about Cordova's 15 feet of snow. Joyce volunteered to answer all those media phone calls coming into City Hall. While the warmer temperatures and rain have helped somewhat, he says, it's also made all that snow a lot heavier. Joyce says residents had to be evacuated from one apartment building when the roof started to sag, jamming doors and windows. It's one of the many roofs yet to be shoveled by residents and others who've come to the town to help. Joyce says the Copper River Highway to the airport also has been closed due to high avalanche danger.
During daylight hours, people are being escorted through with police on a kind of like little convoys kind of things around the avalanche zones.
Large scoop-type shovels are expected in town by Friday. There's also a wonderful new piece of equipment that came in from Anchorage.
It's a snow melter, and it's here, and we've been working on some of the snow that we're pulling off the roads. We've got no place to put. We have like three backhoes just feeding this thing as fast as they can, and it melts the snow and turns it into water. The only thing you have to do is make sure the drains are open so it has someplace to go.
60 Alaska National Guard members have been helping state transportation, city crews, and residents dig out. Joyce sends a shout-out to the guardsmen's hometowns.
They all had jobs, and their employers let them go, you know, to be able to come down and do this. So we really want to thank those employers, wherever they might be in Alaska, to let these guys, you know, come down here to help us.
22 crew members from the Coast Guard cutter Sycamore have shoveled harbor floats, some of which had started to sink.
They've also been really good because they have six mechanics that have been assigned to us to help maintain some of our heavy equipment, you know, loaders and graders and stuff. So that's been real useful, too.
Cordova is on Orca Inlet at the base of Mount Eyak. 2 weeks ago, Joyce says, the Mount Eyak ski area was the place to be.
We had some of the best skiing probably ever in Cordova, you know, with 2 feet of powder. It was, you know, phenomenal skiing. Then last week, after our storm, we have no skiing because the chairlifts are buried.
Here's the current message from the Mount Eyak ski area hotline.
After this storm blows through, we're going to start, and it's going to take us probably about a week to dig it out, depending on how much help we get.
Mount Eyak ski area, elevation 1,230 feet, is operated by the Sheridan Alpine Association. Dave Branshaw is general manager.
We had 15 feet on the snow stake up there, but that was a week and a half ago, so it snowed quite a bit up there since then.
Branshaw says even the 30-foot O-tower close to the top of the mountain is nearly buried. Mount Eyak's historical chairlift dates back to Sun Valley, Idaho's Mount Baldy, where it was first installed in 1936. It was moved to Cordova in 1974 and is one of only two single chairlifts still in operation in the U.S. The other, by the way, is in Mad River Glen, Waitsfield, Vermont, currently closed for lack of snow. Branshaw says a crew started shoveling a path to Mount Eyak's base buildings and shop yesterday. They still have to uncover the rope toe, the base of the chairlift, and midway station. Then they'll tackle the top. But first, there's the town to dig out. Branshaw says it's like a job.
Every day we're starting with a shovel plan, and we get our gear together and just head out there and keep scooping. We usually put in a solid 8 hours every day.
In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
The city of Valdez is holding off on declaring a state of emergency. The city council determined that it will instead look at other resources to address its snow removal needs. KCHU's Tony Gorman has more on how Valdez is coping with this year's record-setting snow season.
During his report to the Valdez City Council Wednesday, City Manager John Hosey said the reasons why the city has struggled with snow removal this season is because of the lack of manpower.
The issues that we're running into is the availability of people to work and the rates at which you pay them. We had to raise our rates twice to try and stay competitive, but even still, we're not close to what some people can get by just going out and doing things themselves.
And quality equipment.
So our limiting factor was really, you know, equipment to put in people's hands.
Those factors are why some city buildings were left with huge snow loads on their roofs, most notably schools in the Valdez City School District. After an assessment of the situation, Hosey said he considered declaring an emergency and made preliminary calls to the State Emergency Coordination Center. The idea of considering such a decision irked some city council members like Joe Prax, who felt the city should have been on top of the situation.
If I couldn't open a store because of this, I'd be on the roof. I'd be shoveling that.
Mayor Dave Cobb agreed with the rest of the city council that he wasn't ready or willing to declare an emergency. The city hopes to attract more temporary shovelers by increasing the rate for a third time. The council will revisit the option of declaring an emergency if it can't find enough workers. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
The coldest days of the year hit Bethel just as students were enjoying their winter break. With the schools empty and the temperatures dropping to more than 30 below zero, the stage was set for a fiasco at the high school.
It was kind of the perfect storm. We had, you know, nobody using the facilities and the buildings during the same time we had the coldest spell we've had for a long, long time.
That's Janelle Vunas, the principal at Bethel Regional High School. She says the frozen pipes were an issue not just for the high school. The freeze-up occurred in the main line that also brings plumbing into the two elementary schools and the lower Yukon School District office. With schools set to resume this past Monday, they were working to quickly clear the water lines and apply heat to help thaw the sewer lines. That's when the story of ice became one of fire.
The insulation then, goodness, lit on fire.
The Friday fire caused no serious damage outside the pipe the school was planning to replace anyway. The Bethel schools likely won't resume classes until next week at the earliest. Weather has continued to be a factor. Snowstorms and extreme cold temperatures have slowed repairs.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you're an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
A large part of southwestern Alaska has been lit up with broadband internet connection capability. The governor attended a first-ever video conference to announce the completion of the Terra project, which crosses Cook Inlet and Lake Iliamna with fire optic cable. APRN's Steve Heimel was there.
We have built it. Now, will they come? In a conference room facing a pair of video screens, GCI made the announcement that it has linked its new broadband network in the southwestern part of the state with an existing broadband microwave network in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. It has a large price tag, but given the conditions and remoteness of rural Alaska, almost any infrastructure project is costly. Governor Sean Parnell connected on what they called the first terrestrial video conference between Juneau and Bethel, said it's now up to Alaskans to imagine what they can do with this capability.
Name your small business or mid-sized business, name your larger corporations, and this enhanced capacity enables more opportunity.
GCI completed the project on a tight deadline using an $88 million financing package from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Rural Development Office. $44 million of that is an outright grant, and the rest of it has to be paid back with revenue generated from this new communication capability. USDA Rural Development Regional Head Jim Nordland called it the centerpiece of the Obama administration's effort to bring broadband capability to the rural parts of the nation. But at the same time, it's also a challenge.
Half of the money we gave was grant, but half of it's loan, and so they need to be able to pay back the money. We want to make sure that that there's a large utilization of this system.
USDA will be looking for ways to stimulate that activity, Nordland said. Speaking from the Bethel end of the connection, Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation CEO Gene Paltola said he's already seen the difference broadband makes in giving their clinics quick access to specialists. They can analyze X-ray imagery, for instance, without waiting for it to be mailed. He said their existing microwave network, built by United Utilities, has been doing this for a couple of years, but this connection gives the system more reliability. Plus, there is more expansion planned, linking it all the way up to Nome, and ultimately along the Brooks Range to tie in with the fiber optic that now runs up and down the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Hopefully, when GCI totally deploys this and comes around and ties into their fiber optic coming down from Prudhoe and we have redundancy, it's going to be phenomenal.
United Utilities does have the future in mind. Senior Vice President Chuck Russell, who now finds himself working for GCI, says they hardwired equipment into the network that could potentially double their capacity in the future if the traffic demands it.
It was designed for an ultimate capacity of 2 gigabits. Its installed capacity today is around 1 gigabit.
The Terra project had to be completed by the end of last year. Russell says they made that deadline by using contractors already familiar with Alaska conditions. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
2 years ago today, an earthquake devastated the country of Haiti and had ripple effects around the world. One of those ripples made it to Alaska, where a family nearly lost their daughter in the disaster. Krista Brelsford was trapped in the rubble and ended up losing her leg. A year ago, her father, Taylor, brought the man who helped save Krista's life to Alaska, hoping that he could get a high school diploma and maybe even continue on to college. But Winston George ended up getting kicked out of school and eventually left unexpectedly to live with family in New York in violation of his visa. APRN's Lori Townsend sat down with Taylor to talk about the experience.
A year ago, we were filled with such extraordinary hope. Winston is a very bright young man. It was clear that he had a lot of initiative. He would talk to me about his mom's hopes and dreams for him to get an education in the U.S. He would quote Martin Luther King about the importance of an education. So, you know, literally for the first months, we were just so excited about the possibilities, the hopes and the dreams and the possibilities. And I think he worked hard in school. And yet, in the end of the day, he's a kid. He's a bit of an impetuous 20-year-old, and so I would say the value, the goals, the purpose behind the homework, the standards that I would push or the school would push, they weren't big enough to hold him. I think he felt like he could have a little bit easier time doing some other things.
2 years now after the earthquake itself in Haiti, that terrible tragedy there, how is Krista, your daughter, who was injured very, very gravely, very severely, and Winston was one of the people that helped to get her to safety and to treatment, how is Krista doing with her new life after healing from her injuries?
She's a kid full of drive, full of joy, full of fire. Physically, I think the first year was more difficult than she ever let on to us. She now talks about trying to talk with patients, with other people about managing pain, phantom pain and other. I think it was harder, but her drive is so strong that, you know, she was aggressive. She was ambitious to be hiking, to be climbing, to be running early, and she's at 100%. It's really quite astonishing. She is focused on preparing herself professionally to make a contribution that in the future will include Haiti, but she works hard on her academic program. She's moving through her PhD program at a fairly young age, and I think she puts it in perspective. It's a part of her life. She says a phrase that I'll always remember. You know, sometimes you pick a place in life and sometimes a place picks you. And in that respect, I think she and we see this as an ongoing part of our world, our lives, but it's not all there is.
What personal lessons have you taken from being so affected by the earthquake in such an intimate way? Your family was so directly affected, and your involvement trying to help afterward. What's changed now for you?
Well, I also remember those first days, and I remember just the words jumped out of my mouth that we will be loyal for our lifetime to the people that saved our kids. And that explains and guides, and that's good enough in life. We have the chance to do that, that the compassion shown to our children in a particular moment, we would never repay, but it is part of us forever to be a part of rebuilding, of contributing to the ongoing good community work in that village. The people who looked out for us, we will be a part of that. And of course, it's a bit of a cloud to have for now a bad experience around Winston's education, but he's a 20-year-old kid, and of course it deeply rocked me to have that appear to have been a failure. But on a better day, I do remember that you give because it's who you are, and it's part of being the best person that you can be, and you never know what the outcomes are going to be. One small failing is not the story. The story is that compassion heals. People acted with compassion to my children. Our ability to contribute in those communities is part of making good out of this terrible experience, the terrible loss in Krista's health and so on. Compassion heals, and I know that all over again. I still remember it.
Taylor Brelsford is an Anchorage resident. His son and his daughter both survived the Haiti earthquake. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson and Matthew Smith in Nome, Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, and Tony Gorman in Valdez. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, and Steve Heimel and Lori Townsend from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Nominations are due by February 14th. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.